Good morning, everybody. And thanks for joining us. The intent is to brief the results of a study that began quite some time ago, actually. And it was born of the genesis of Ron Sega and the Air Force, who had an interest in taking a look at the health of the space industrial base and what the impact of ITAR and the export control system was having on it. There was, as you all know, there has been sort of mounting commentary and frustration and comments about what was going on and the arrival of and the marketing of ITAR-free products, for example, has first shown up in the space sector. And so that began the genesis of the study. We put together a working group, and I'll take you through it, of people that had a lot of deep expertise inside the space sector, as well in terms of space policy, people who have actually been in the space sector, everybody from large companies to small entrepreneurial companies. We briefed the results to our sponsor now about 3 weeks ago, and this is sort of the first sort of, you know, public rolling out of it. Let me put it also within the broader context of what's going on. To the extent that when we started this study, we thought we were going to be one of the first export control related studies to be coming out, and since then, however, something has gotten in the water in Washington, D.C. Many of you heard me talk about this. There are now 18 export control reform studies, efforts, workshops underway in town. Everything from inside the government, inside, you know, State Department, Commerce, DOD, as they look at their internal processes, NIAG, which is the NATO Industrial Advisory Group, just did something out in NATO. Many of you hear from the MOU group, there's work internal to here. Industry has been pinging at this from multiple directions, including the Grand Coalition, which had a response back by the administration, Hudson Institute, Heritage Foundation. Right? There's a broad swath of efforts, and so from that perspective, people doing broad export control work has been there, and I think the group as a whole, we decided to then focus therefore very much on what could be done within the space sector rather and let it reflect upon the larger export control effort rather than make this a broad export control reform project in and of itself to the extent that it fits as one slice. Now, I would say that I think that space has become in some ways the canary in the coal mine to the extent that the ability to find evidence of impact and has probably shown up first in the space sector, where you can do it in more stark contrast, for example, than in any other ones. And the other sort of preview comment I would make was, and I think the group as a whole would agree with this, you know, to the extent that everybody was looking for big smoking guns, we didn't necessarily find a huge smoking gun, but we found the whiff of gunpowder is kind of the way that I sort of phrase it. Okay, can you go to the first slide? One of the first things we want to start with in terms of putting the right context, and I think it's another thing that has shown up in almost all the other export control reform efforts you have in town, is that we start with the premise and the beginnings, and I think the basic philosophy of the study was to start and looking at it from a national security perspective, not an economic one. That to the extent that there is an argument to be made about whether you should or should not have reform, that it should be done primarily because there's a national security issue rather than an economic one. And from that, we very much sort of embraced where the U.S. national space policy sort of began. Next slide. The task force, again, we had a dual task, look at the health of the space industrial base as well as look at the impact of ITAR. Next slide. And this is the group. Tom Young, Bill Ballhaus were the co-chairs. Two, for those of you who don't know them, two individuals with just deep, deep expertise and great reputations in terms of space policy. Lon Levin is with us here. He's from Sky7 Ventures, but He has a much more storied and interesting history than that in terms of his background. Individuals such as, again, Tom Moorman, Bob Walker, Paul Kaminsky. So we think we put together a very good, solid group. The one thing you should note that this report is a consensus document. In other words, the entire group has signed off on the findings and the recommendations. Okay, and for any of you who have worked in sort of committee meetings, you know what that's like to sort of nuance every single word and get everybody to agree to them. But we thought that that was pretty important to have that put into place. Next slide. The methodology, fairly standard in terms of how we do these things in town, did a whole series of interviews, talked to a lot of experts. The one thing that is, I think, fundamentally different than a lot of these types of studies, through the help of AFRL and the Department of Commerce, we did probably the most comprehensive survey of the space industry, I think, that has been done in 5-10 years, if not ever. It was a fairly long, detailed survey that asked lots of questions about the health of the industry, impact of ITAR. We picked up lots of data. We had the nice advantage that if you don't fill out one of these Department of Commerce surveys, your CEO can go to jail for up to a year. And so everything was filled out, and we had very, very good returns. It's a little nuance of Department of Commerce studies I never knew about. And so we were able to put, I think, a lot of facts behind the analysis and the study that was in place. The survey and that study has been released by AFRL, correct me if I'm right, so you should be able to find it somewhere in the in cyberspace, to the extent that if you want to get deeper into the data and find that out. The one thing I would note is we did tweak the data somewhat differently to the extent that they focused as much on the space services market as well as the hardware market. We looked really much pretty primarily into the manufacturing base. Next slide. We also wanted to start with a series of principles, again, to make sure that the whole group was grounded and that we had a commonality of, or at least an understanding in terms of where we're going. Some of these are motherhood and apple pie, but it was important to sort of put them out there to make sure that as we were sort of approaching it, we had a commonality of view. The fact that space is absolutely critical to national security, that leadership for the United States is an important thing, that there is a great interdependence between all the segments of the space community, and I think that's one of the fundamental things that underpins part of the argumentation, that there is enough overlapping between the defense, intelligence, civil, and commercial sectors of space that that damage in any one of those areas actually does damage more broadly. Industrial base is important. That export control policy and having an export control system is an important thing. That if you can make an argument for any sector where you do want to maintain controls over technology, that space you can clearly argue is one of those important things. However, you also need to have unimpeded access to global technology on the part of the United States in order for to achieve all of these other sort of goals or principles. Next slide. So if we can, I'm going to briefly go through the results, and then we'll dive into the details. On the health of the industrial base, what we found was that the financial health of the top tier of the industry, after sort of having gone through a pretty horrific period in the sort of post-telecom bust, was good. But there were areas of concern within the broader health of the industry that had to do with human capital, that had to do with program execution and sort of systems engineering skills that had to be looked at. And in particular, where there are vulnerabilities that are beginning to show up in the health of the space industrial base, it was really in the second and third tier of the industry. And I think that's a theme that you're going to see picked up throughout the study. And that one of the other important findings is that the U.S. space industrial base, and for those of you who live in it, it may not be that much of a surprise, but it's something that had to be brought out, is largely dependent on the U.S. defense national security budget. In other words, that the space industry looked a lot more like the shipbuilding industry, for example, or others, than in some of the more broader commercial ones. And so the implication was, and one of the comments I think we delivered back to the government sponsor was essentially, you own this industry from that perspective. And therefore, that takes you down a crossroads or a path of either you adopt a strategy that, for lack of a better term, can be deemed, you know, an arsenal strategy. In other words, if you're responsible for the health of the industry, there are sets of policies you need to pursue, or you encourage it to participate in the broader global economy, allow it to diversify away, and broaden its economic base, so you kind of get out of this. This is not a new argument. We went down this argument in some ways with the high-end computing industry. We've gone down this argument with lots of other sectors of the economy, but it is really one that has sort of shown up on the, frankly, on the crossroads as it relates to the space industry. And if you're going to go down the path of I want to encourage or allow this industry to therefore participate in the global economy, then that takes you down the path of then I need to take a look at export controls and the ability to compete in that global economy. Next slide. So on the landscape in terms of that, what does that global economy look like? Clearly, there are rapidly emerging foreign space capabilities, and the U.S. does not control their proliferation. What's been amazing has been to see the amount of cooperation that's sort of going on outside of the U.S. or even the West's sort of purview. That U.S. preeminence in space is under challenge in many areas. This was somewhat of a controversial, I think, finding. We had to debate, what does that really mean? Have we lost preeminence? I think the conclusion of the group was no, but there is an erosion from the bottom and certainly an assault in particular areas. And that in many places, the current U.S. export control policy has not prevented the rise of foreign space capabilities. And in certain cases, it has had the perverse result of encouraging it. In terms of building of capabilities. We heard some interesting testimony where there were certain individuals came in with glee and said, U.S. ITAR has been the most fantastic thing for us. It has allowed me to go to my national government and ask for more resources for our industry, and we've been able to build it, so you guys keep it up because it's fantastic for me. Thank you very much. And that was, somewhat of a stunning sort of set of comments. And so the grand strategic intent of the space export controls, and if you look at what the congressional language read when they made the change, for example, they were very clear in what their strategic intent was. I think you can safely say that grand strategic intent is not being met. And in some cases, you can find where the export control policy is actually running counter to the national space policy. And in particular, in one area of the national space policy, it says that international cooperation is one of the fundamental underpinnings of it, and that the U.S. benefits from access to foreign innovation and human capital. And that access, I think we've been able to demonstrate with some of the data, is getting increasingly more difficult. Next slide. That it is constricting U.S. engagement and partnership with the rest of the global space community, particularly where in certain areas, we're able to find in niche areas, for example, in anomaly resolution, where the inability to do real-time anomaly resolution without a license is causing, is putting at risk operational issues. There's been lots of testimony by NASA, for example, in front of the Hill that's talked about this topic, and it's one of those issues that has come up here. Next slide. That when you look at it from all of those looks have been looks from policy, from national security, and sort of where it fits. If you begin to look at it from the perspective of now the industry, U.S. has been losing share in the international market. Study after study shows this, with the greatest burden actually being borne by the second and third tier. So once again, here we pick up this theme that the real impact is showing up on the second and third tier. that, and you can make the argument, and has long been made the argument, is that second and third tier that we rely upon to provide a lot of the innovation and development. What's stunning in the actual data, the large primes, and this has been corroborated in other areas, spend about 1.5 to 2% of their revenues on IRAD, internal research and development. You go down to the second and third tier, and you see 5, 10, 15% of revenues being spent on internal research and development. And there were a couple of who came in and talked to us about, clearly, you know, if I cannot sell overseas or if I'm restricted, the loss of those revenues has a direct correlation in terms of how much money I have left over in order to put into that investment that I'm able to do. And so that's why we really, really sort of zoomed in there. The goal is to bring the space export control policy in line with the national space policy and achieve its strategic intent without, you know, eliminating the negative consequences. I think, Lon, tell me if you would agree that if the group felt that the strategic intent was being achieved, we probably would sit there and say, okay, maybe I can live with the economic consequences of it. Exactly. So it's more the reverse, the fact that, okay, if you're not achieving your strategic intent, then I should go after, you know, why pay the economic sort of burden of it. And frankly, there was a unanimous agreement, and we've seen in other studies, that we think you can sort of do enough reform to the system while still preserving national security and achieving the goals that you want to go. Next slide. So the recommendations. I apologize for the eye chart. One of the biggest things is that there has been a disconnect between the administration and the Congress in terms of what they really want the strategic intent of the space control export control policies to be. We've now had this debate, or it's been going on for 8 or 9 years, the notion of getting the two groups together and sort of reconciling that is probably something that, not probably, is something that should and frankly has to be done. That the key here is to identify the critical space control, space technologies that you want to keep on the munitions list, and then move the satellites, the overall satellites, back off the munitions list onto a commerce list. The fact is that the munitions list is too much of a blunt instrument to achieve, the strategic goal that you want. If you want the mere fact that the instant you put the overall satellite on the munitions list means that every component underneath it and everything that touches it underneath it becomes a munitions list item, which is the opposite, we think, of what you want to do. Identify the parts you want to control. If it's a particular solar cell, a battery, whatever, say, I don't want that, or I don't want that in a particular category, and then move the overall. And that will eliminate, frankly, 80 to 90% of the weirdness that goes on in relation to that. So that is a key. The notion of doing an annual review or a periodic review then of what is on the list has long been there. The new presidential directives, I think, sort of encompasses kind of this philosophy that there should be periodic reviews. And actually, if you read the legislation very carefully that put satellites back on the munitions list, it's actually one of the items that says that should be done. It's actually one of the items in the legislation that we ought to have a periodic review. There is a default sort of set of recommendations, to the extent that if you don't want to go down the path of moving the ComSat's commercial communication satellites back onto it, the mere fact that you have a piece of legislation that relates to this particular sector gives you the opportunity to then bring in other best practices under that legislation if you want to. And again, it matches in many ways what the presidential directives that were just released talked about in terms of set timelines, technology thresholds, de minimis rules, special licensing vehicles, for example, for international cooperation. We think that the NASA administrator, SECDEF, as well as, you know, SECSTATE, who currently has it, should have the ability to, the authority to grant real-time case-by-case exemptions to the anomaly resolution problem. It goes on today to the extent that everybody is so mission-oriented. If there was a problem going on real-time, you know, would people sort of talk to each other in order to get it done? Probably. Does it put somebody in jeopardy, you know, legally by doing that? Probably. That's no way to run a railroad. And so in some ways, the ability to have that authority, we think, is pretty critical. Picking up on a notion in other areas, a special program authority to permit engagement in multinational space programs, it picks up on this theme that you're seeing in lots of other export control reforms of trusted communities or special communities. We've had that notion that was built around the Joint Strike Fighter. Many of you are engaged in that. You can sort of make an argument about whether it's working or not working. It picks up on the notion in many ways about what the U.S.-Australia, U.S.-UK treaty are about creating trusted communities. To the extent that there's international, multinational space projects that we want to do where there's a trusted community, the ability to have an exemption under that is there. Increasing the dollar threshold for satellite exports, congressional notifications, since it's never been indexed to inflation, that's just a good housekeeping type of thing. And then as far as the industrial base is concerned, a periodic review of the industrial base with all the communities involved. It's back to this notion that they're all interrelated and interlinked, and therefore taking a look at it as a group is useful. There is a growing venue called the Space Industrial Base Council, for those of you who don't know it, that has a lot of the constituencies involved. That is a good place to be. In many of the other areas where we've seen big movement in defense industrial relations between government and industry, it's usually been communities, frankly, that have gone through near-death experiences, like the ammunition community, for example, in the 1990s, where now they have these venues where you see industry and government getting together and hashing out these types of issues in an open format. And that's something that we sort of can only encourage. So that's the quick sweep through it. We'll slow down the pace a little bit and sort of take you through our journey that we've gone through. Next slide. And at the risk of I'm willing to have this somewhat interactive to the extent if you've got questions, pop your hand up and we'll see if we can keep the pace going. Go ahead.
Question. You mentioned the concept of sharpening the munitions line. Has anyone gone through the exercise of saying, okay, here's the Department of Defense says, here's the things that we really need to protect, we need to stay on the munitions list. Well, now let's run through the caseload and see how it impacts the caseload going through the state and through the district.
So in relation to space, that wasn't done, or I'm not aware that that's done. It's one of the recommendations, the space community has sort of said this is something we should do anyway. What you'll find with the caseload for related to space, it's not a big number, okay? But some of the most complex cases fall in the space sector. And so one of the things you'll see in the actual data where things are really getting gummed up, for example, is in the TAAs, the technical assistance authorities, because they're really, really complex and take the time. Where that kind of an exercise has been done was in relation, for example, to the US-UK, US-Australia treaty, where they found out that of the 70,000 licenses, 19,000 were related to the United Kingdom.
At 99.5%
are passed, and so it goes back to this notion of, if I have scarce resources related to this, how do you get them to focus in on the really most complex, difficult ones rather than that?
For the technologies that are manufactured by the U.S. second and third tier suppliers, were you able to speak to somebody at, let's say, Euroconsult to cooperate? Loss of market share on the U.S. end is equating to a gain of market share on the European end for those specific technology areas.
So as is typical for most of these studies, we certainly were able to do that, to have clear evidence of that anecdotally, where there was an American product, it was deliberately designed out, which equated to flat-out loss of market share. Does it show up in the overall macro trend data? No, on the second and third tier, because we didn't have that data Yes, on the top tier, to the extent of satellite market share, you can show that, okay? These are things that everybody's looking for, right? And that's why I say, you know, if you're looking for the blatant smoking gun with, you know, Mr. Pim's laying next to it in the chalk outline, you know, it's not quite there, but there is gunpowder in the room, and there's enough that you could sit there and say, I'm confident of standing up here saying that there is an impact, okay? So the first sets of findings related to the health of the industrial base. Next slide. The health of the industry, like I said, is good. Can you click on the profit chart? Let's see if modern technology works for us. We tried to do this in a clever fashion. No, back up one. Just click on the red, it should go to the page. Technology does work. The red or the top tier are the primes. Tier two is the light blue, and the dark blue is component suppliers. There's two things that jump out at you related to space. One, again, is sort of this, you know, that's the bust, the subsequent bust, as well as the choking on some of the other, you know, big satellite projects and programs that are going on. The other thing that jumps out at you is that, you know, the average profit margins for this industry are actually structurally lower than you would find in the broader defense aerospace area. And so from a relative comparative perspective, that's sort of one of the other issues. But it's also why, you know, with the bounce back that's going on, and it extended into 07, the backlogs that are underway, the mere fact that we have probably, you know, one of the largest recapitalizations of every space asset that's out there in the national security space arena, most of the people that came from the industry side said, well, it's going to be hard for us to really whine and complain about, you know, our financial outlook, given the rebound that was there. The fragility is certainly there to the extent of, it was not that long ago, though, that everybody was sort of on their backs. If you can click back to the main presentation. Next slide. The areas where there were identified weaknesses in that second and third tier, and this is work that was done at the Space Industrial Base Council, Aerospace, in terms of identification of particular areas where there was either you're down to one supplier, you're down to one supplier who is financially weak, you're down to a set of suppliers who are financially weak. There are particular areas where that were identified in terms of specific, you know, sectors. The other thing as well that, and we're not going to dwell much time on it unless you guys want to, there have been lots and lots and lots of studies that have been done that have looked at the whole space-related workforce. The fact that it's aging, you know, you have the whole Apollo generation that had sort of grown up and that is going through, for lack of a better term, block obsolescence as they go there. The particular gap where it's beginning to show up is exactly in that cadre of people that you would need to be graduating or being promoted into program manager, program director, you know, those levels. And the fact that there has been a slower pace of development means that the ability to generate the skills for that industrial base is less, right? And so there is a linkage back into this topic to the extent of, if lots of program experience is what makes a good systems engineer, a good program manager, and you're working on fewer programs, less things to learn on, learn your lessons on, that is a bad thing. To the extent that you can work on international programs, other programs to sort of keep that pace going, that is a good thing. And so there is a linkage between sort of this arsenal hothouse version of the industry versus one that is globally engaged. Next slide. The issue, again, in terms of the program management and systems engineering skills, you don't have to click on that, it has been sort of well identified. Mormon has done some, the Young study that's out there. We wanted to acknowledge them as a group, sort of pay homage to them, sort of say that it's been recognized. There are initiatives in place to begin to address this in terms of trying to rebuild that cadre of people. Frankly, our comment back is it's going to take you almost a decade to rebuild this cadre of people. And so it will be continue to be a looming issue as far as the industrial base is concerned. Next slide. And in terms of what part of the industry is sort of dominated by defense, when you again take a look at percentage of sales on the manufacturing side, you get a very different picture if you include services, because there you have global players. 50-60% of this industry is fed by, supported by, works for the national security space community. And that's why the message back to that community was, you really sort of dominate the landscape. This, again, these types of percentages look more like what you would find if I were talking about the naval shipbuilding side than, for example, if I were talking about aerospace, which has a better balance between commercial and military, or if I were to go to any of the electronics sort of sides of the industry. Next slide. Excuse me?
Domestic non-defense
would be what we people would call civil, the civil space. Right.
So the protective market and commercial market, which is not.
Right.
You're more of an arsenal state than even that.
Then that's correct. To the extent that you would, if you were to fold into NASA and all that, it would show an even bigger government sort of. Now, take this back 20 years and it would be all red, right? I mean, so there is an evolution of the industry underway, clearly. So that was the message, and I think that the message was certainly absorbed by the sponsors, and they're working their way through in terms of what do they want to do about that. Next slide. On the export controls, next slide. So for anybody who's in the space community, as you guys are, you'll know this, right? Where we were once part of a very exclusive club, the number of nations that are active in space continues to grow. We've got triple the number that have their own navigation systems, double the number of countries with their own reconnaissance. You've got a dozen countries that are now able to launch their own satellites. Israel just launched a satellite on an Indian launcher not that long ago, for example. 38 countries with operational control over their own commsats. I mean, you go stat after stat after stat. Take your any time frame, and one in particular, pick 1999 as one of those sort of time frames. There has been a continued proliferation of technology. Even more critical, the sophistication of that capability continues to increase. So in terms of commercial imaging satellites at a meter of resolution or less, when before that was the magic number that everybody wanted to get to, there are lots of other countries that are there. Civil radar imaging, which is an extremely sophisticated technology, is there. And so this proliferation of that, of sophistication also continues. Next slide. And where once upon a time, the U.S. had a technical and qualitative lead over the competition in terms of commercial communication satellites, that gap has closed. If you want to click on the table, and you've got the detailed table back on page 47, but we took a look, again, we used 1999 as sort of one of the demarcation points, because that's where the technology changed. It's an eye chart, you've got it in the back of your books, but whether it's number of transponders, lifespan, payload, weight, in many areas where the United States a decade ago simply had an advantage, that gap is now closed, and everyone else is offering equivalent capabilities. Doesn't mean that the U.S. isn't trying to develop better ones. Doesn't mean, frankly, that the Europeans also aren't trying to develop better ones. But again, where there was that gap, it has changed. Go back to the main presentation. And so, the message back to the broader world, and in many ways, the message back to to the Hill on this topic is, as much as the U.S. would like to control the spreading capability, there's international cooperation that continues. without us. Whether it, and in many cases, it's the Russians who sort of are engaging around the world in terms of the this proliferation of the, of this technology. Next slide. And these other spacefaring nations are continuing to make strides whether they have access to U.S. technology or not. I mean, the most striking one is the pace of evolution of what the Chinese space industry has been able to achieve in the last 8 or 9 years. We can debate endlessly whether it could have been faster, slower. You know, I'm not going to engage in that debate because I don't have enough data, and it becomes sort of counterfactual analysis. I just stick to the very simple point that if there was certainly a strategic intent articulated in that legislation, that intent is not being met to the extent that the proliferation continues. Period. Full stop. Next slide. And the and in some cases, as we indicated, it is begun to encourage it. And so there you pick up the evidence, whether it's the Indian space program, whether it was deliberate spending of funds to develop capabilities in Europe, where the push to develop sort of the ITAR-free satellite is there. There, I think, is where, you can find the very specific and targeted pieces of data and evidence. And it brought us to this conclusion that the grand strategic intent of the space export control policy is just not being achieved. Period. Full stop. Next slide.
Here,
go ahead. Oh.
Pierre, Colin Clark of Space News. If you look at this, can you boil this down and say the legislation did not do what it intended? It had the opposite effect.
I'll go all the way with you on the first half of the sentence. It did not do what it intended, comma, in some cases it had the opposite effect. I'd just modify that.
Do we have statistics?
I think we have statistics from the perspective of, I would call the ITAR-free movement as having the opposite effect, right? So I have confidence in standing up and saying that.
If others can build a satellite, that's the evidence.
Right.
The club is growing, that's the evidence. Not in all cases, as Pierre says, but just...
You can see the headline. I'm just trying to make sure they were all on the same page.
It'll be even bigger.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Next slide. This is a non-uncontroversial area, right? Next slide. One of the key elements that when we started looking back in terms of the ability about sort of the overall engagement, and one of the notions we wanted to get across, because I think in some ways the history of the technology development gets muddied a lot of times, and particularly the view of where U.S. preeminence in any of these technological sectors comes from is sometimes we forget the history. And the fact that the U.S.'s strength is that we have played this model of being the world's vacuum cleaner of technology, and in terms of raw technology, raw science, and bringing it in. And what the U.S. has actually been very good at is the ability to take that raw technology, using that Yankee ingenuity, and actually turning it into products, whether it's defense products or other products. There's lots of sort of allies around and friends around the table, and I'm sure a lot of them would nod about, yeah, that's right, that was our technology, and you can go down the list. We were looking for modern examples as well as historic ones, because if I keep going back to Wannes von Braun, it starts to get a little tired. Okay, that was 50 years ago. Show me where we are today. The most modern version of that is actually the RD-180. Engine, to the extent that the U.S. had not been investing in that kind of technology for almost 10, 15 years, and the Russians were. And we've had to go there and leverage it. You really see it when you start to go beneath, down into that second and third tier, in terms of the basic underlying technologies that are going on that underpin solar cell technology, that underpin some of the other basic technologies. not to mention the fact that, you know, we've also been the world's vacuum cleaner of people that are interested in coming to the United States and studying engineering and science and historically keeping them, right? As Friedman and the flat world argument, all that, some of them these days are going back or they're coming back. Next slide. And what the other part of the unintended consequences, or where the friction in the system because of the system begin to show up, is that the collaboration is starting to get harder and harder with the changes or the differences in interpretation relating to the deemed export rules related to a lot of the other ones. There have been other studies that have focused in on this topic. We didn't want to spend a lot of time on it, but we wanted to pay homage to them and note them, because I think it has an implication in this sector to the extent that of that mounting friction. So National Academies has done multiple studies on this. I'm desperate trying to remember the name of the Augustine study, Falling Off the Map, Falling Off the Cliff. Yeah, and then there's a subsequent one.
Is America falling off the flat earth?
Is that one, right? Is America falling off the flat earth? Right, that sort of really gets a lot at a lot of these issues. Clearly has an impact, I think, on the space sector. Next slide. The one area where it's really beginning to constrain the engagement, we found it more in this area than we did on the licensing side, frankly. Is in the TAAs, where the average time it's been taking to approve has doubled. In other cases, you've seen actually an improvement in licensing of hardware times as everybody's been trying to tweak the system and improve it. And the biggest thing about this is that it's disconnecting itself from the pace of business, right? And so, and you can make an argument on the national security side, right, that there's a particular pace of operations and there's a pace of business, and the export control system is getting disconnected from that pace of business. And so one of the biggest things we kept hearing is, you know, I'm usually asked to respond within 60 days for an RFP. And the mere fact that it's taking 100 days or longer, I'm just getting fundamentally out of whack in terms of my ability to go from here to there.
Quick question for this and several of the other recent points. Does corporate ownership make a difference? You know, we've seen some of this acquisition of a Canadian or potentially UK firms. Does corporate ownership help either, you know, with some of the process running a business, these timelines, alleviating, you know, enhancing integration? Or is there some test cases out there now and you kind of wonder...
Yeah, we certainly didn't look at that topic in this study, but in other work that we've done, I don't think you can sort of draw any correlation. The only thing that it does is clearly any American entity owned by a foreign player is just that much more sensitive to export controls and ITAR and that much more aware of what it means. I mean, one of the biggest things that the second and third tier sort of came back with is, you know, we don't even know if we're violating these rules, because a lot of times, you know, we just never deal with it. And so from that perspective, there's certainly much more of an awareness. I'll add one other comment. I think one of the reasons why industry has become that much more focused on export controls in the last 2 or 3 years and has been pounding the table has also been in the reverse, right? That for before, for most of the industry, it was somewhat of a theoretical topic. It was me cooperating with another person. Now that the industry has become much more globalized and it's becoming an internal issue, you know, I can't talk to my UK subsidiary or my European subsidiary or my Singaporean. It's become that much more of a visceral and real thing, as opposed to, okay, it's friction in the system, we can live with it. And so from that perspective, I do think that these changes of ownership have made it that much more of a pointed topic.
Here, just a comment, a question. I think we're doing ourselves a disservice, if not even being a business leader, when we talk about the TAAs, we just focus on the time for TAA approval. for those of you who have gone through the process, like myself, unfortunately, getting approval from the TAA is just the beginning of a much longer process. If I was done in 106 days with the TAA, I'd be sitting at home in the office having coffee and a donut right now. What happens is I get the TAA, then I spend another month, 2 months correcting the provisos in the TAA, then I have to implement the TTCP, which takes another 2 months, then I got to go to SpaceLink to actually be able to submit the information. So really, the process is 6 months, 7 months after the TAA approval. I'm wondering if the CSIS looked at all at the time required, not just the TAA approval, to actually be able to communicate the information.
So there were two things as we were briefing that we were asked to go back and look. And one was, okay, how many of the licenses and or TAAs are getting passed without provisos? I couldn't get comprehensive statistical data. The anecdotal information says 99%, are getting slapped with provisos I shouldn't even say that. Let me rephrase that. A huge percentage, if not almost all of them, had provisos put into it. We did get a very specific one, and I hate to go to anecdotal because we very much resisted wanting to go there because I can always find the horrific anecdote. But this one was kind of interesting enough, where it was a TAA for anomaly resolution that was approved, but it had a proviso that said you can't do anomaly resolution, right? So you can find those all day long, okay? We didn't want to go down the path of just listing little anecdotes because, frankly, the answer comes back of, well, that was just one. So we were looking for more statistical. It is safe to say that almost everything goes through with some sort of sets of provisos. The retort back is, hey, that's what got you your license. Be happy. I could have said no. So now you got your license, but with provisos. We can debate that endlessly, whether that's better or worse. The issue about the timeline, you're right. It is worse to the extent that, and one of the things that we just frankly didn't get around to but wanted to do was do the long sort of horrific pachinko sort of machine chart of what does it take to go from one end to the other. And you're right to the extent that, you need the approval to do the marketing. Once you start the conversation, you need another approval. And there we did get people giving us evidence or testimony that it's not really one. Usually for any marketing campaign, I've got to go through this five or six times to go all the way through the end from beginning to end. So your point is valid.
Yes, I'd just like to add to that. The timeline also, this timeline, in addition to not including the time that's consumed by the work that was previously referred to, of course it doesn't refer to congressional notification either, and the thresholds become an issue, the process becomes an issue. The other thing that I would just mention here is that it's not exclusively the timeline, which is something that the government continually focuses on to let everybody know that they're improving and so on and so forth. It's really the volume, particularly in these international cooperative efforts, very, very complex, huge investment on the part of the U.S. government from a policy standpoint as well as from a dollar standpoint. And the multiplicity of licensing, TAAs, and so on, really impedes in a way almost more than the extended timelines. And I think that's an important factor that really needs to be identified here.
So two elements related to that. One, I'm sorry, I forgot the first one. The element about the volume. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. To the first point. We came, I think, with a philosophy of if I can make the case with as much good hard data and the minimum amount of data, and it makes the case, stick to that. And if it's even worse than that, well, then that just reinforces the point, and we'll let everybody else sort of wave their hands and set the bridge on fire, right? From our standpoint, this was bad enough, let alone the further reality. And there are plenty of other people willing to talk about the further reality. The second element is, on that point about the number of licenses, so to be fair, on this case, I think we found that that, and in other work that we've done, there's two sides to that story. It's as much things that are generating lots of volume, it is also as much that the industry is putting in that many more licenses out of a paranoia and fear about, you know, boy, I better put one in just in case, right?
But Pierre, that's business practices that are caused by British discovery policies. They're doing this out of paranoia. Well, you know, after you've picked on a few times, that's not paranoia.
I realize it is a controversial statement what I just tossed out there. I would just say to be fair and balanced, that there was as much of a there was as much of that came out there as well. Okay.
The only corollary I'd add, that was kind of a lot of years ago, is I've always been concerned that you spend too much time focusing on the metric of time, because if there's an inverse correlation between the shorter it is, the more provisos or RWAs you get, because that allows the guy to get the stuff out of his zip basket. And so you got to be careful what you ask for. You can shorten the time by 20 days and discover, which you won't get hard data on, the number of provisos has gone up 20%, and the number of RWAs, which takes no time at all, has gone up 20-30%. And so careful.
Fair enough.
You can measure that, but that may not be what you want to measure.
Fair enough.
Curious as to whether you looked at the number of days in 2007.
We had the data up through April, I think, and the trend line continued.
Okay. You mentioned ICARP earlier. I wonder if you had any luck quantifying the trend in ICARP.
Hold on that. So let me keep moving on. Anomaly resolution in this area came up a lot. Okay, as one of those areas where that's not related to time, is one of those things where there was a considerable amount of concern that this was an issue waiting to happen. And in a couple of cases, it has occurred where there was an anomaly in a real-time situation. You had to be able to talk to, it was either a foreign component on an American satellite or an American component on a foreign satellite. And the inability to sort of, you know, real time right away start talking to each other about something in order to get something fixed did pop up. Ultimately, they did it, you know, but it's a topic that is continued. And this was specifically written into legislation in terms of laws and what you had to do. And so, you know, that is a fix that you had to get to. Next slide. This is an eye chart, but I'll let you sort of peruse through it. If you take a look at the U.S. National Space Policy, it makes some very explicit statements about international cooperation and what you want to do and what you want to deal with. And from that perspective, the fact that the friction that's being generated in the system sort of runs counter to that is where we can sit here with comfort and sort of sit there and say that there is a disconnect between the National Space Policy and actually in some ways where we've ended up in terms of how it's actually on the export control side it's being actually executed. Next slide. In terms of the markets and in terms of the you know, the share and the evidence from that perspective. Next slide. Can you click on the red? You know, study after study, and I don't care which study you pick, you know, shows this erosion in the market share. Right. Next slide. This is one done by, you know, who switched red and blue. You guys can, again, confer the next slide. Yeah. And go back to the main. These are a little bit of a Rorschach test. You know, people sit there, will then sit there and point, oh, hey, it's ticking back up at this last one, or it's this or that. I come at it from just a very fairly simplistic fashion. You stand back and take a look at that, market share has eroded. There will people come back and say that, well, maybe it was other effects, maybe it was this, maybe it was that, you know, but in the end, there was a stark point in time that occurred, and subsequent to that, there has, you know, the U.S. market share has eroded, period, full stop, okay? There have been flat-out comments by customers that previously bought U.S. equipment that have said, we're not going to buy from the U.S., period, full stop. Okay, that's as blatant as I think as you can get from from there, and from that perspective, there's one customer. And as anybody who's in the space industry knows, every customer is precious. And in other areas where we're able to specifically identify U.S. components being designed out and or capability being built, whether it's the Apogee motor, thruster control valves, star tracker, the basic bus, etc. And this is anecdotal. We haven't been able to track it down. Maybe somebody from AIA or another place can find it. You know, there are RFPs beginning to come out with the phrases in there, you know, ITAR free. Okay, actually in the RFP. So I think that's where, and you had hints of it 2 or 3 years ago. I don't think you could have said that today. I think you can point to specific things. Next slide. Now getting into the surveys, you know, where you're beginning to, you know, it's clearly showing up that frustration in the industry, whether it's I don't understand the requirements, you know, half of the industry is sort of saying, I don't even understand the requirements, let alone, you know, what they are. The big thing about the I think the other element of the time where I do focus in on the time is also the unpredictability element, right? Because from the ability to sort of plan, do strategic planning, run a program, where it begins to have an impact on strategic decision making, right? Next slide. And what really, really shows up in this is, and it links back to our original strategic point about, you know, do you want an industry that's able to engage globally or not? You know, while the industry was extremely confident about it being able to participate and compete in the U.S. marketplace, you know, 98% sort of, can I compete in the U.S. marketplace? Yes, I am. I'm very comfortable, you know. Almost half the industry sat there as, in terms of just a lack of confidence about being able to engage in the commercial marketplace, the global commercial marketplace. And that is, we would go back to making the statement, a strategic issue. And in some cases, we're able to actually make the correlation between people who have abandoned the international marketplace, who have said, I'm just not even going to bother, you know, competing in it. Next slide. Yes, and I can get you that data if I remember right. It got worse lower down the tiers, as you probably would expect. Okay. When you ask, you know, what's your number one barrier to foreign, you know, markets by industry? Click on that on page 53. U.S. export controls becomes the sort of the bugaboo. About a quarter, though, talked about sort of internal preference, right, which is not to be dismissed. And I think there's a somewhat of a correlation back and forth between these two in terms of what's being used as an excuse for the other, right, in some cases. Next slide. Go back. Be careful with this finding, okay, because there's... We put it out there because it's there. We were able to get it. We asked the industry in terms of to identify programs that where they had applied for a license but lost the work either because of the time it took, they sort of missed it, or for some reason related to the export control system, they could attribute a loss of business. Okay. When you sum that up, it turned out to be about $600 million per year, okay? The caveat that I say about that is because we asked each individual company, what we weren't able to identify is five people may have been bidding on the same thing, and so there might be double counting in that number, okay? So I'd be a little bit careful on that. The flip side, what it doesn't capture is work that they didn't even bother bidding on because they had sort of lost hope, right? So between the two of them, you know, maybe it's right, but it sort of gives you an order of magnitude of a number that at least some people can, you know, can put it there. And the real thing where it shows up again is in that second and third tier of the industry, where if you look down in that third tier, they are spending 8% of revenues for export control compliance, right? That's a huge number. If every, you know, percentage point of that was put into IRAD, you know, that's that's where it really shows up. At the top tiers, it's sort of, you know, it's absorbable, which is why we make the comment that the real impact, the real burden, is actually being borne on the second and third tier of the industry. And in some cases, for some players, the ability to wind their way through the export control system and know it really well is a competitive advantage, frankly, right? Next slide. That's the issue, right? The instant you put the commsats and satellites onto the munitions list, you inadvertently, whether you intended to or not, and there's again evidence when you talk to the staffers and the people that were involved in that process that they really never intended to go down into that second and third tier. So again, if you want to go to what the intent was, the impact has been the exact opposite, right? That it captured and it swept under all those second and third tier players into this system. They're the ones who are paying the burden. They're the ones who are being hurt. They're the part of the industry we look for in terms of for innovation. And so therefore, we have this negative feedback loop that's underway.
Just wrote, the law says ant-related components. So even if it weren't for the ICAR, it's by law that everything on that satellite is on
the ant. But the subsequent sentence defines ant-related components, okay?
Yeah.
Into a very limited list. It's the mere fact that it moved to the munitions list, and the munitions list specifies that everything that's inside it is what trips it up, okay? I don't disagree, you wouldn't need to deal with both, but I think in moving one over, you would have it would go a long, long way, because that other ant-related components was very specific. And it does go back into interpretation and others, right? Now we're getting to the nuances.
Did the Commerce Department study ask the second, third tier players whether they had been told by overseas customers, we're not going to use you anymore? Did approach from that, because that's something that obviously would also play into not asking for a license.
Right.
Not only that they decided themselves not to bother, but that former customers from overseas came to them and said, we don't need you guys anymore.
We asked specifically where you had lost sales related to export controls, and so to the extent that they answered it that way and picked it up, I don't know if you remember the specific questions or results, whether it showed up that way or not. There was a very specific question that asked, you know, can you identify areas where you had lost sales related to export controls? And so, to the extent that somebody came along and said that, it would have been captured in that set. I don't think we specifically asked, you know, have you ever been told, go away, because we're not going to use
you. We had anecdotal evidence.
We had anecdotal evidence, again, in the testimony of people coming in saying that was the case.
Just to follow up to that, the frequent mention you had of anecdotal evidence, at some point, anecdotes become data.
I don't disagree. Yeah, look, there are lots of studies out there that there's plenty of anecdotal evidence out there. I don't, and this collective group, I'm sure, could, you know, if we spent the next hour, everybody tell me your horror stories, we'd come up with a nice long list. Philosophically, we definitely wanted to come with an approach, though, that the more you can put as much, you know, statistically significant, you know, hard data that you could rely on, let's go there, because there are plenty of other people that can serve up good, hard, personal experiences of what they're going through. And what we really wanted to avoid was and we actually had this in our testimony with a very prominent, you know, congressional member of Congress. We gave him the anecdote. Well, give me another example. We gave, well, that's just two. How about give me three? We gave him three. Well, give me, and you can keep going until you run out of examples, and then the instant you run out, you say, aha! See, it's not structural. You've only given me 32, and there are 70,000 licenses. So what the heck are you bitching and moaning about, right? And so that this issue of the more we...
Peter made the point, when a group got together, you could imagine us all whining about the situation, and we spent some time with that until we said, well, we could spend all of our days doing that, or how about we get down to some hard data and really look at the situation on a statistical basis, and that's what the result of this is, not the anecdotes.
And I don't think we would have gotten to this nuance of the first and second, third tier, actually, if we hadn't done that, frankly. Right? I think we all kind of came in with a particular view, and it was the data that sort of got us, I think, to where we ended up in terms of, you know what, it's really the second and third tier that's getting whacked.
So, Peter, getting back to costs for a second, has anyone looked at the direct costs that we're paying at BTC? I don't know about everyone else, but we get these just bills that say, you owe me.
You should say who you are.
Yeah, Michael Bigelow Aerospace. And we're just asking people, did no breakdown in terms of what the money was spent for. We then go back to ask questions, and to the best of our knowledge, we're paying about $130 per hour, per person, plus travel, plus expenses for our monitoring. We paid on our Genesis One campaign over $160,000 just on the straight export control, much less my salary. And I'm wondering if anyone's done an analysis of that, where that money's going towards. As I say to my Russian counterparts, you know, they may be spied on by the KGB, but KGB is a good currency not to charge them. And if I can just add to that, you know, they did here compliments to you as I asked for, you know, these conferences. As you recall, I had some relatively harsh comments, was it last week, at the panel that I was on with you. If I were paranoid, 1 week later, I got a bill from NHTSA for another $9,000 for work conducted in 2005. And while, you know, we at Bigelow Aerospace aren't going to go broke on $9,000 or even $160,000, I'm very curious where this money is going towards, and if anyone ever receives a breakdown as to how it was done, where it came up with, and kind of what those statistics are, and if you have them, what.
In terms of the burden, the AFRL, Department of Commerce study, that was one of the things we specifically asked for. What is your economic burden? That's where we got the $50 million number for the second and third tier. We have a first tier number. You'll find it in the broad. In that study, you can get to the actual hard numbers, and we can get you those numbers as well, right? Next slide. Policy. Next slide. So the group definitely started from a standpoint of, we are not advocating popping the whole world open. We're not advocating letting this technology out. Again, if you put it within the context of the broad export control, you know, system, if you look at everything from, you know, berets to space technology, any logical person would certainly put space technology at the upper end of the things that you'd want to sort of watch and control, right? And we start from that premise that this is not about popping the world open. This is about focusing and doing it appropriately. And we really sort of zoomed in on this capability significantly better, you know, type of concept, which actually, once again, is embedded in the national space policy. The national space policy actually, frankly, gets us to where we want to be, I think, philosophically. Next slide. There are, as I noted, a whole bunch of export control reform efforts underway. I think where you can pull some of those threads and pull them into this issue, this debate, you know, this community, whether it's what the Coalition for Security and Competitiveness argued for in terms of, you know, how do I get streamlining, better visibility, better transparency, these notions of trusted communities that's beginning to bubble up, that if you look at the broader export control reform efforts, everything from the way that the Department of Commerce is trying to take a look at verified end users in China, US-UK treaty that embodies this notion of trusted communities. There ought to be the same thing in the space sector, for example, in terms of there are trusted communities that we have participated with for a very long time. You know, how do you pick up on those notions? Reviews of lists have been called for 30 years, probably ever since lists have existed. People have said you should review the list. There was an NSPD related to a review of a list. And in the end, it frankly boils down to the responsible entities and agencies, you know, with the willingness to sort of go down and actually and actually go in and do that review. But the identification of, you know, what is sort of critical technologies, capabilities that you want to keep is I think, certainly embodied in what we're talking about. Next slide. The State Department had their own study that was done a couple of months ago, where they came to, you know, fairly similar conclusions about, you know, the ITAR list is too broad, it's too much technology, it's adding, you know, this phrase about delay and uncertainty, you know, the State Department has heard about it from their own advisory groups. Next slide. And that takes us to, again, back to our list of recommendations, if you want to go one more slide. And so the basic philosophy, just to encapsulate, you know, at the heart and the meat of what we're talking about, because there is controversy related to this, clearly. To the extent that we have gone through an evolution and we have seen sort of where we've gone in the last, you know, 8 or 9 years, and we link very much 2 and 3 together, to the extent that if you're going to go down a path of putting the overall satellite back onto a commerce list, you have to run that parallel effort of identifying the critical technologies on board that are the ones that you want, you know, to control. Therefore, it sends a very clear signal to industry about what is allowable versus what is not. And I think that gets you back to what the original strategic intent was as well, in terms of where you go from here to there.
Given number 3,
yeah,
how do you rewrite the law without opening even more worms?
The interesting thing about the law is that it's, you can amend the law without having to touch ITAR.
Yes.
All right.
Except for the commercial satellite components.
Well, that's where you get to the nuance of ITAR. The instant that it moves back onto the commerce list, right? The commerce list, the other side of the expert does not have that phrase that sits there and says that the instant that the item is put on it, all subcomponents or anything within it is also a munitions item. And so the moving back of that, I think, pops you out of that, which is also why our protection, because you can see the natural reaction back of, oh my God, if you do that, there may be a special doodad that I want to control, and, you know, you idiots, you've just, you know, popped this whole world open, which is why we've very much said that go to the responsible agencies, and in particular, you know, DOD, which is charged with national security, and have DOD come down and run through that list and identify for me. I actually don't want solar cell panels above this capability. I don't want this, I don't want that, I don't want this, and I don't want that. And those are the things I care about, rather than the blunt instrument of, don't put the satellite under there, right? Because 3/4 of that satellite you may not care about. The hydrazine tank that's about to drop on our heads.
Which is a commercial tank. Obviously.
Which is a commercial tank. A very well-made commercial tank if it's going to survive all the way down and drop on my head.
I wanted to go back to Chart 7, which I think you have later on in the discussion, and in particular the conclusion here about the national security community owning the U.S.-based manufacturing industry.
Yeah.
That, certainly, no question. But then the sense here seems to put the onus on the national security community, therefore, to either provide for the health of the industry or to encourage and enable it. And my question is whether it makes sense for the onus to be on the national security community, given, and your recommendations reflect this, given the multitude of elements in the federal government as well as the Congress that really have to play into this and really have to accept the responsibility, step up to the responsibility to doing, in fact, both of those things, not an either or. And so it has to come from the top. It has to come from the White House. It has to come from Congress, and not that I'm any, you know, great defender of the national security community per se, but it just seems like, you know, it's just put there inappropriately.
Let me give a quick response, and Lana, if you want to respond as well. Remember where we started this premise that we start this with, frankly, with a national security lens in terms of how we look at it. And from that perspective, we think that if the national security community doesn't step up to that it is a necessary but maybe not sufficient condition, but it's certainly a necessary condition that the national security community, one, has to buy off and one in terms of the health of the industrial base, and also as well as this. If the national security community says, no, you guys are wrong, we don't believe any of this, I don't care about what anybody else says, none of this is going to happen. And so we consider them very much at least a necessary part of it, and I think that's the flavor that you pick up because of that. If the national security community were to step up 100% of the plate and do everything that we asked, would it still get us all the way there? No, because there are other components and elements that's there. But at the very least, I think you have to start there.
And just to reinforce what Pierre said, we start with the notion this is about national security. This entire discussion is about national security. There are entities in our government who are responsible for national security. You may have issues with their abilities or all of that, but they are who they are, and they are identified. And we were trying to hold them accountable for these decisions. This is an entire part of our economy that's critical to our security, and we want them to be accountable for these decisions. So if the structure presently needs to be looked at least if there are certain things that they don't want to be exported, then identify. Don't have an umbrella approach, which may be politically expedient. Step up and say, these are the things we do not want exported for whatever reason. So it's really an issue of accountability for the people who have been empowered to protect us.
The other thing I would note is we, I think, found a good commonality of view, actually, on the executive branch side between all the relevant agencies, DOD, Commerce, State. So unlike in the broader export control reform debate, there's more differences. Actually, we found a surprising amount of kind of common view, and here the disconnect, I think, is more between the executive branch and the Congress in terms of, again, differences of view about, you know, what's the intent of this and where do we want to go. And even there's movement, I think, on the Hill side, which is why of all the things that we're working on, I actually have a great deal of hope that there was going to be some movement on this topic. I think the timing is ripe for that there's been enough movement and enough sensitivity to this topic. So the Commerce has fixed timelines. It moves you there. I know you can stop the clock on the Commerce side. The neatness of it, and I think its biggest impact. I think if you're a major satellite, that's a good question. There are experts around the table that could probably tell me better than I could the answer to that. I suspect that if you're on the satellite side, I don't know how much is going to change in the beginning. I think it's going to make a big difference if you're on the second and third tier.
Okay.
because in some cases your item, you know, may not even be licensable at that point, right? And again, and which is why from the protection standpoint, because you can see where the counter argument will be back, which is why we wanted the national security to sit there and say, on the things you do want, mandatory referrals to DITSA, you know, because we care about that doodad or not, then give that list so that way everybody will know that you either don't put them into the satellites or you know that you're going to go through that. And frankly, if you have those on, then you're right, then that timeline will be the same as it was before. But now at least there is a clear view of, okay, if I want to avoid that, then just don't put that in there.
I ask because it's kind of a mantra, and, you know, and I think a lot of people think you can't see it, but back to the conference, but I think, and it's kind of what you're saying, it's a first step.
It's a first step.
There's still lots of work to
be done. It's a first step, and frankly, though, it's so if you put us now back in the context of the broad work that's trying to be done in looking at the export control system, it's a first step that philosophically, though, fits into, you know, I think the overall notion of that what you really care about is who it's going to, right, in some ways, and so there are those elements, as well as can you strategically pot out or figure out what you really want to spend your scarce resources, you know, tracking, watching, monitoring, controlling, versus the commodity items. Now, space is such a small subsegment that you're not going to find your 30,000 licenses go away. But, you know, it's a small subsegment of that. But philosophically, it fits inside that overall view, which, again, if you go back to what's at the basis of the US-UK treaty in US-Australia, if you've got 19,000 licenses out of 70,000 going to the UK, and how many, and all of them, almost all of them are approved, and a good chunk of them is a piece of an Apache that I've been selling to them for 10 years, you know, I'd rather have that person spending time tracking down who exactly is that company in, you know, Iran, China, whatever, and are they really somebody that ought to be getting a piece of equipment, right? That's where you want the resources at.
Thing about the commerce difference between State Department is that the parts components under commerce would be assumed they would lose their identity as a part of the
Right, there is a de minimis.
You have a de minimis.
Right.
So as long as you're shipping it domestically, there would be no licensing issue at all because something like an A to D converter would become part of the commercial satellite.
Right.
And you get licensed for the satellite.
Right, so I know it sounds like a magical panacea. I think we learned a couple of lessons last time around that shift was made. I think the recommendations encompass parts of those lessons learned. It is a step forward. I think it would be a big step forward, but there is more to go. Right, there would clearly be more to go.
Continue on your recommendations.
Yeah. Terry.
One of the things I think the debate on commerce versus state. I've been in this for a long time, and I was in the 2000-2001 major policy paper that was produced at this table. And during those days, frankly, the defense interest side of the table didn't even know about commerce, didn't want to know about commerce. There was a completely different view, theologically, doctrinally, philosophically, different world. And I think that was completely short-sighted. Commerce has an extremely tough enforcement program. People go to jail and stay there for a long, long time. So I think it's very important for the defense ITAR folks to accept that commerce has a significant role and significant institutional resources. And unlike state, unlike DOD, they have a requirement to balance the economic interest versus the security interest. They have cops, they have badges, they have guns, they have jails. But they also take into account constitution. And I think that's a really critical factor that you're addressing it here. But I think it's very useful for people around this table who are DOD or may well be DOD or DOS oriented to realize that's over there. Just one nice minor little point. If you want to have composites for the design of super advanced civil aircraft. That's under commerce. It is, however, heavily influenced by the Defense Department. So piece of the action is in it for sure, but it comes out of commerce in a balancing test. And I think we really ought to be looking at that direction.
Follow up to that part. If you take satellites off the list, you still got the issue of the design for modified for DNA problem, which is to say you have to, the QRS-11 issue you had in civil aircraft, you've got it, but I have to go back and find out what was the origin of an actuator that's now used on a commercial satellite. Was it developed originally with DOD money in 1975? And if it was, you're still on the munitions list until state comes to grips with the design for a modified form versus the policy language, and I hate to use the number, the 120.3 in the IFAR, which says if it's got commercial applications, you got to look at it. State, unlike commerce, has a simple way out. If it has any DNA that's military, it's military. And I don't have to ask how many MPOPs does it have, how fast is it, how advanced is it. I don't ask you anything. So a dome light that was developed for a military helicopter is a munitions item, period. So you're asking, the only point I'm making is that space can't go it alone until state is willing to do that fundamental policy issue of every single, I think it's, you know, 8 out of the categories have the design for modified language. So that, you know, you won't find actuators or thrusters on the munitions list. The question is were they designed for or modified for a military product, or did they have design money with R&D money from the Defense Department at any time, then you got a problem. And so what I'm making, this is one that you're going to, that is a generic policy issue for the munitions list and the ITAR as to how you handle it for everything. It requires decision making and thought, which is a problem.
So we have a different venue for the broader export, you know, of the 18 CSIS is working on, visibly working on 3, and we're, you know, got her fingers in lots of the other ones. That's a broader effort for a different day, different topic. That being said, as well though, I think one of the other elements that is part of this sort of proliferation of capability in a flat world is, and unlike 10, 15 years ago, you have, and as sort of Bigelow back there can tell you, you have a true commercial industry that is developing things commercially without that DNA, right? And so to the extent that you have the movement off of that, I think it is a step forward. This is not the, you know, the clouds will part, the sun will shine, and the angels will sing, life has been solved, right? You got many of you who've been in the room, who have been in the export control reform, you know, business far longer than I have, and taught me that that we take our victories, you know, one step at a time. I think we take victories where we can, and we make those movements. I think everybody's kind of become so cynical that movements are poo-pooed as opposed to, you know, that are celebrated. I mean, I will take those presidential directives as a victory. That was a good movement. I know everybody around here has been like, eh, you know, that was a good, positive step. I'll take every step forward. I'll take that as a huge step, you know, and so we keep chipping away at it, because I think if anybody's hoping for a flat out burn it to the ground and rebuild it and all life will be better, we'll be at this, you know, for another 50 years.
Ask a sort of follow-up on that? Do you then try to pursue, especially number 3, separately from larger changes?
Yes, yes. Partly because I think it begins to solve a specific issue relative to a specific industry that has a particular problem, and frankly, again, I would call it a sort of a canary in the coal mine, to the extent that this industry, more than almost any others, I can begin to build that data and the evidence, and you can make the argument. I also think there is enough, it's one of the few areas where there is the beginnings of commonality of view on the executive branch. There is movement in up on the Hill in terms of evolution of thinking related to this. And so if you think of sort of the pacing of items to sit there and prove, again, we got the administration, the administration, you know, has made a statement with those presidential directives. We have two very important other events underway with the US-UK, US-Australia treaty that, again, are pretty fundamental in terms of the evolution of a way of thinking about things. The verified end user sort of movement in terms of common, that's a pretty fundamentally different view. I kind of plug this in as one more sort of stepping stone that gets us to, okay, I'm getting more and more comfortable with what this new world looks like. So I would argue, yes, you do. We kind of cheated a little bit with recommendation 5 and said that if this is too politically difficult, you know, there. Ironically enough, because you have this piece of legislation related to the space, I can tinker with this without changing the whole thing. I can start to bring in some of these commerce. I shouldn't have said that because that's going to kill it. You can bring in some best practices thinking from other institutions in terms of, you know, timelines, de minimis rules, technology thresholds. You can try to bring that into this community. And then down here there are some very specific tweaks that I think that you can pursue that would mean a lot to the space industry, particularly like the anomaly resolution, which I think is a critical one. And this one, you know, 7, you can also frankly pursue without the broad reform, because this says, let me find islands of tolerance where you can accept, just like we've done with the US-UK treaty, US-Australia treaty, the JSF sort of, you know, the program exemption licenses, you know, that we're trying to create, where I can find a pocket. Fine, we've all agreed that we want to build the International Space Station together. You know, if I'm trusting you with the lives of my astronauts with the things, I ought to be able to trust you with the equipment, you know, giving you the equipment that can do it. It's a little bit of that philosophy.
Do we think Chairman Berman is going to make a difference?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know that landscape well enough.
Just remember, he co-sponsored the Rohrabacher amendment to take satellites off the mission.
Fair statement. No, that's true.
Right.
That's true.
But that was that.
The cynics come back.
Was NASA very much involved in this at all? And if so, what was their attitude? Because I would think they wouldn't want to see a decline or an exporting of our satellite capabilities.
All the relevant entities were involved. So NASA was gave quite a bit of input and was actively involved. The international cooperation issues, the issues again related to the anomaly resolution, was a big issue for them, and their ability to do international cooperation was a huge issue. The fact that and this is not a NASA issue, it came from other places. The fact that companies are asking, there's double loops going on where companies are asking, you know, we're asking foreign government officials to sign agreements related to, you know, ITAR and export control, even though that there's already a government-to-government agreement, but the companies are trying to sort of cover themselves as well. It's causing weird kinds of loops. So they were very much involved, along with all the other members of the community. I mean, we had NRO, DOD, State, Commerce, you name it. They were all sort of providing input into this.
Pierre, is there anyone from Director of Defense Trade Controls in the room today?
I don't think so. Not today.
And see, that's to keep the cynical.
Well, hold on. Whoa. Wait a minute. So you guys, that to be very fair, okay, when we 3 weeks ago when we briefed this to our sponsors, they were very much in the room. We had DoD, NRO, State, Commerce, the Intel community, NASA, DARPA. I mean, everybody that you could ever conceive of having a say in this from the government side, executive branch, government side, was in that room sitting. They each had a seat around a table equivalent to this, and I took them through, you know, through all of this.
Yeah.
So they're not here today, but they were there when we talked about this.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, but I'm kind of wondering who they are. Because I come to a conference like this and I sit in the room and I hear what
the director. Let's put it this way. Everybody was at the director level. Okay, this was done at the director. You know, I guess I can talk about who was. Can I talk about?
Well, whether you can, they're as high as you would need them to be.
They're as high. Believe me, these were at the what's the euphemism? At the highest levels.
Yeah, but see, that's exactly my problem. I got friends in low places.
I knew you were going to go there.
But let's say the reform doesn't happen. Let's say it isn't swinging to Congress. As we, you know, you mentioned it's a step-by-step process, and that may be a big one that may not happen. I think it would be eminently useful for DTC, not just at the director level, but at the front lines where people are writing provisos, are monitoring launch campaigns, for them to hear this and hear the recommendations and see what's in this report. This is an excellent report, and I believe it would have huge impact on the people on the ground if they were exposed to some of this. And thus far, I do not think it's been communicated down from the upper levels of the DTC to the people who we work with on a daily basis. And I would encourage you, you know, we at Bigelow Aerospace, you know, we're fast private sector guys. We want to see change soon that actually impacts us. And I think one of the ways that can happen is the writing of the provisos, you know, as you and I have discussed. If DTC would just take a more sensible trying to provide it, that would certainly solve 90% of our problems. And to the extent that you folks can arrange to brief DTC and make that a recommendation, I think would be hugely helpful. And this is a wonderful report that we should use.
So we are now, and all the members of the working group have sort of raised their hands and are willing to begin to proselytize the report, and we're willing to take it wherever. Wherever there's an audience, we will take it. Okay, the electrons of this report will be up, you know, tonight. Feel free to send it wherever you want. Okay, that's part of the, you know, part of the thing. And the other thing is that our sponsors who have absorbed this are working on, you know, on absorbing it and coming up with reactions and comments. And I think you'll see something in the next couple of months as well. So to the extent that we can act as a catalyst to get this debate re-energized and going again, I'm more than happy to do that. We had, again, a lot of congressional interest in this. We'll be taking it up to those people, you know, up on the Hill. At the CSIS thing last week, you heard the congresswoman sort of say, you know, I wish there was an export control study that would look at the impact. And so I went up to her and said, interestingly enough, we just happened to do one, you know. How's that for responsiveness? And so, you know, again, we'll take it wherever it needs to be taken.
A brief comments.
Yeah.
On the graphs, finding one talks about weaknesses of the second and third tier, financially weak suppliers, but the supporting graph shows an increase in profit margin year-to-year for tier three. It's like you might be prepared to something going, aha, but possibly better.
So
to break down into tier three.
Because we have the survey results, we can go into literally company by company. Although I think the way the regs are written, we cannot specifically identify. But it's why we again identified in the subsequent slide, you know, specific sectors where we can point to really targeted areas where that weakness is showing up specifically.
Okay. And to follow up on someone asked for a second, third tier graph on finding 10, I think on finding 3 would be good to have a tier 3 graph.
Finding 3 is...
We've got one for tier 1 and tier 2 on finding 3. But we talked a lot about tier 3 in international competitiveness and globalization. We've got a tier 3 graph right there.
Yeah, Oh yeah, we've got, and actually it, as you would expect, well, so three is interesting, and enough of these charts are sort of dense enough that I didn't show up. Three shows up actually pretty close to this, which is really counterintuitive, because as you, most of you know, if you go to almost any other sector, it's tier three where you really expect to see the big sort of conglomerates, because there you're doing componentry, right? And that was one other element that was part of the other underpinning of, you really end up, you own this industry more than a lot of others, because if you're down at that third tier and it's that dependent on defense, in very few other places, again, I keep harking back to shipbuilding, but shipbuilding is one of the only other few areas I can think of where you have tier three suppliers that are that dependent. If you were to go into C4ISR or aerospace, you know, that's where you truly hit the big conglomerate, you know, the, I was going to say the Rockwells and Honeywells of the world, but it's even below that, where there are others that are doing multiple components. We have that data. We can, if you want to see it, we can certainly send it to you. And I think certainly the AFRL study, the AFR Department of Commerce version of the study breaks out all three tiers, if I remember their data right, the way they report. But we have the data. Comments? Discussion?
Just to touch on the point that I raised at the beginning again, expand a little bit. I'm a little skeptical about the increasing the specificity of the USML as a tool for improving things. It sounds good in principle, but I think in practice it'll be difficult for a couple reasons to link to mind. One, if you look at the pace of technology, it's not clear to me that it can keep up with it. You brought up the solar cells as an example. If you were to specify that a certain quality solar cell is on the USML, but lower quality is not, how quickly would that be outdated? So how often would you have to update that? That's one thing. And then second, as I brought up earlier, once you got the exception list from DOD and others, it might be that you have lots of specific things that are exceptions that have to stay on the USML. But the aggregate impact of that is you still are processing the same number of PAAs, same number of licenses, you get the same number of advisors or thereabouts. So in practice, you haven't really made much impact. So not to plug CSIS for another study, maybe my friends at NSSO can take this on, but I think it'd be worth war gaming, you know, proposed changes to USML before they were adopted to see, do they have, you know, the desired effect?
It was very much in the back of our heads as we were sort of debating the, you know, are we going to create a war system? Not. The issue of the list constantly getting out of date, I think, is always a structural one. And again, to take us into a different venue in the broader export control reform work that we're working on, that's one of the issues that we're looking at deeply, because the natural reaction for 30 years has been review the list, and you keep coming back to the same thing, and yet the other answers of, well, are there ways that you can sort of, you know, pre-vet things or whatever, then I can't make it GS-13-able. It's back to friends in low places. You know, those friends in low places actually have to execute, and you pop out and give them free reign to do everything, and I'm not sure that ends up being, you know, a better answer or not. Now, the one element that gives me a certain amount of optimism about this area is I think you've got the national security community in related to space who's at least willing to step up to the plate to, you know, to begin that exercise of what would that list look like. So I think the beginnings of that exercise, you know, that there's a potential, you know, to do that. If somebody has a much better way of figuring out how to do the list problem, I would love to hear it. You know, short of, if we keep drifting towards this notion of, you know, is it really back to a resource problem? Is it, do you create a group that is their job? You know, a center of technical expertise that does it, you know, that at least provides a technical expertise. The policy decision is a different one, right? Because technically you can sit there, because you can still have a policy decision and says no.
Yeah, it's a tough question. And like you say, you need a system that GS-12 or GS-13 is going to be able to say yes to and not fear for their job afterwards.
Right.
That's when rubber meets the road, what we're dealing with. And just the general concept versus the list, and I don't know how this would work, I'd love, you know, as he suggested, CSIS to follow up, but if a technology or a system is widely commercially available, if you can show that I can purchase X from Alcatel or from the Europeans, that should not be on the USML, it should not be under ITAR. So maybe not a list, but a statement that you can show proof that you can purchase as good, if not better, technology from elsewhere, it should not be considered USML.
And the concept is certainly embedded in the rules and regs. The problem is again, it's back to technical resources to sit there and prove that or get there. And how do you keep up with the rapidly changing pace of technology and proliferation? But I think that's going down the right. Now, there is also an element that my friends at State remind me, which is the thumb screws to dictators issue, right? That it may be widely available, but certain things we just don't want us to sell it. I don't want it, you know, I don't want it to be an American thumbscrew, even though I can get thumbscrews everywhere. And that's a legitimate point of view, which is also why, again, in some of the broader efforts, and frankly, it came through in this effort, we think that there are three legitimate points of view that should have, should have equal viewpoints, a national security sort of DOD one, a foreign policy, you know, state one, and a economic commerce one. The trick is how do you minimize the friction of having those three points of, there's goodness in having those three points of view. By having three points of view, you're going to get inherent friction. And so the trick is how do you minimize the friction while sustaining getting those three points of view. Uh-oh.
That's a tremendously wrong fundamental assumption vis-a-vis commerce. Commerce has an intense devotion to the national security. And it has to balance it internally. It doesn't just say, we'll sell it to whoever, we don't care.
Fair enough.
Fair
enough. And DOD, and
you
look,
have to get beyond that.
Well, fair enough. And DOD has a commercial viewpoint as well in terms of, you know, export sales lowers the unit price, and state has a national security view as they would constantly, you know. So there are three points of view. Having all those three points of view at the table is a useful thing, is I think is one of
them. But the issue of resources, being the least that if you're as a fallback position, if you look at all at increasing resources at GDP state and business.
So this study was not focused on that topic. You will see some, I think, there is recognition inside the national security space community that resources is an issue in doing that. It is very much something that the, you know, Grand Coalition for Competitiveness addressed and in the broader work, you know, that we came to. That we're doing, that clear recognition of that. And in fact, if you look at it philosophically, this town is divided into two camps, right? That if you just put the right resources and the right business practices in place, you know, that actually, when you really read the laws, it actually gives you quite a bit of flexibility and plenty of room and maneuver. That if you put the right resources and business practices, you can get this thing to work. And if the timelines dropped to 2 days, everybody would just shut up and life would go on. There's another philosophical camp that sits there and says it will never get the right resources. You can't get, and so therefore I need to structurally change how I'm doing that to compensate for that. And that's really where you hear the two sides of the reformist camps come from.
Yeah, so I was wondering
Well, space is a volume. It's back here. But space is a volume. Doesn't kick high enough. That we didn't go down that path because you can't make that broader argument on what's going on the space one. It's more, can you put the right people in there to think through the complexity of the issues more so than a sheer volume. At no point did the State Department people sit there and say, oh my God, I'm overwhelmed with space licenses. You know, it's more that they're overwhelmed with, you know, small munitions licenses in some way. Right? That doesn't mean that that's not a valid path. It's just not what this study is about. It's an extremely valid point on the writ large effort.
Yeah, it's not on the study, but I have to push back against the fallacy of resources. Trust me, the answer is never more bureaucrats. That is not going to solve anything here, folks. It's an indeed plenty of resources. What's wrong is they're wasting their time on technologies that don't matter. I mean, I have been on a campaign and confidentially had a majority of our bits and monitors say that we're wasting time. These are technologies that people have. There's plenty of resources. The solution is get DITSIT and DTC to focus on technologies that actually are militarily sensitive and allow them to stop wasting their time on items that can be purchased at great pressure.
Well, that's why I say that I was, maybe I should say that that was my central part of it too. I said if we can get nothing more, if you get more resources, then I'm not. Dealing with bureaucrats every day, there are a number of them that are very dedicated, but they're overworked and they don't have a very good system. And if they had more resources, if that's all we could get, and we could get TAs approved in 30 days, that would be a big improvement.
Again, I would have to just. My problem is not the 30 to 60 days. My problem is that I A, have to go through the process, and B, after those 60 days, I got to do the TPCP, the space link, etc. The answer is not to get more people into the, it's not more bureaucrats, it's more freedom. Give the DITSIT monitors more freedom to make choices. Give BTC more freedom to make choices. And frankly, empower and protect them to fail. I think that's the solution to the resource issue, not simply adding more people, because then we'll just be back here in 2 years.
And for this particular topic, not the writ large one, I go back to recommendation one, right? Just from the perspective of, again, we did not spend a lot, we wanted to make sure we had a fairly cogent national security argument long before we got to the economic one. Because the Congress was pretty, in fact, it was very blatant in its stance about that. Actually, if you can go to appendix one. They were really blatant about it, which they essentially said, U.S. business must not be placed above national security interests. They couldn't care less.
Yeah.
Couldn't care less. And so that's why we really, it's in black and white. And so from that perspective, it's got to be more, are you achieving your strategic intent or not? If you're not, okay, then let's change it for that reason. And if it has the benefit of making all that, great. Because I think if we lead with the economic arguments, it's going to fall on deaf ears. Right? And that's why we spent so much time making sure that we at least had a cogent, logical argument about on the national security front, which is why it reads so national security heavy, and I read your point, but I think that's where it's got to start, because if we cannot make that argument, I don't care how much whining there is, it's just, they're like, I couldn't care less. Different on the export control writ large, right? But on this area in particular, although I would argue not so different on it, but really for this area, it's got to start from the, are you achieving your strategic intent or not?
Offer, but you know, you brought up the fact that even for technologies that are perhaps available overseas, there's cases where the United States doesn't want to sell it. It's probably worth noting that this is not the only tool in the toolkit for export.
Yeah, goals, right.
Right. I mean, there are other ways to achieve that goal. And we do
right.
That today.
Right. And again, now to pop up at the broader level, what that keeps telling you is that what you really care about is not what you're selling, but who you're selling. Right. And I think that's where it really starts to take you down this path of we are beginning to build the philosophical, you know, foundation work for what you can kind of see what the future system looks like. And I keep hearkening back to, for example, the verified end user stuff and the US-UK treaties. Really, at its heart, it's as much the who as it is, and because once I trust the who, I kind of sit there and say, I don't care what I send to it. If I trust you, it could be, in the UK's case, I trust them with nuclear technology, and I trust them with my, you know, my most sensitive intel. Clearly, I can do it for, you know, the proverbial 8-inch rubber hose, which you've made infamous, you know, on down. And I think there is an element on the space side. I mean, there are certain countries that we have that kind of a relationship with in space. There are others we don't, right? And that is, in some ways, more the determining factor than the what. And that might be the beginnings of the of your way out of the box.
Where does the MTCR fit? Chris?
Sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Where does MTCR fit?
Probably not going to answer.
Where does MTCR fit into this?
Well, MTCR establishes certain guidelines that affect both munitions and commerce dual use. And some of the relaxations that some people might be looking for aren't going to come on the commerce side when you're MTCR controlled items.
Which is why we started with satellites rather than going to launchers, because as we sat there and stared at launchers, we were sort of like, you know, there's... As we start from a national security standpoint, you understand why there's those things in place. It's back to, let's start with logical steps. As time progresses, you're going to meet more and more this issue of, okay, universally available, you know, blah, blah, blah. The fact, though, that a thing that goes like this, you know, goes like that, based on physics, sort of puts launchers in a very particular regime.
Yeah, just on the point of having lists and having to review, I mean, it is worth noting that that's exactly what Commerce has to do. And one reason, that's good news is that there's precedent for that. The Export Control Act, which of course has been defunct for 10 years or so, but unlike the Arms Export Control Act, does differentiate between foreign policy and security in a way that the Arms Export Control Act doesn't, which is one reason it's so murky as to what state role and what's defense's role. You would think defense would be security and state would be foreign policy, but take that. Final point, the bad news, of course, is the reason that Commerce has so many more licensing offices per licenses, of course, is what they're looking at is stuff that needs to be controlled, by and large. And so their decisions are much more difficult. They don't have 7,000 Smith & Wesson licenses a year, which one guy can handle.
Yeah. Well, look, again, philosophically, if you go down this path, what it says is that you... If the system has the bulk of the focus and the effort in the middle of the actual license, it says you want to be at the other ends. The front end in terms of thinking through what and really identifying who, right? So it places a bigger burden on sort of the intel side and the, you know, who is it that I'm sending to and thinking through the what. And on the back end, on the enforcement side, right? Because to the extent that I'm going to get it out of there, that means that if you violate it, boy, there's going to have to be a couple of public square shootings to remind everybody that was a no-no. We would posit in the end that's a better system with the focus on both ends than trying to get at really what you're trying to get at through the middle.
In addition to looking at past possible losses, like the $600 million of losses, ITAR versus Commerce, has there been a forward-looking projection at how the markets will actually expand with satellites not being subject to an arms embargo?
Yeah, great question, and that was sort of, that was one of the key questions on the part of our sponsors, which was, okay, so let's assume this happens, you know, will it actually help? Will it actually expand the market? Will it actually grow? And that piece of analytical work has been left as a, let's go do that and take a look at it. Not us, but I think they're going to use some other people to look at that, because it's an extremely legitimate question, right, of does it change the landscape at all? From that perspective.
And who's looking at that?
I don't know specifically.
Ah, okay.
And then along with that, how do we justify that the economics of selling to countries with whom we have an arms embargo will help national security?
Oh, we're not saying that.
Oh, okay.
Nowhere in here did we say that. Okay? Nowhere in here did we say that. Because now you're still back to the who. Okay? just by moving it back to Commerce does not mean, and in fact, the fact that you do have an embargo does not mean that that stuff can go to those guys at all, okay?
Back to the reasons for control.
Back to, right. At no point did we go down that path, all right?
Space programs that often matter of national property. Did you look at this in terms of saying that even if the ag terms are tightened up, that there are a lot of countries, particularly more prosperous, as a matter of national pride, are going to want to have these space programs, and they can increase things or they can develop conditions?
Well, we spent some time on that, and it was part of this. It was part of the unintended consequence because ITAR became the foil to justify further resources within their internal sense of politics. In fact, we had a couple who I'd rather not specifically say who, but were very blatant that sat there and said, you know, it is probably accelerated our program because we're able to make an argument that, okay, if I can't get, this is perfect justification for why we need our own indigenous, and oh, by the way, it's something that we want to do and make us, you know, sort of, you know, prouder, blah, 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 blah. So it you cannot pin it. This is not a smoking gun. You can't sit there and say ITAR caused it, because sit there and say that it was certainly used as a foil and certainly used as an excuse and certainly used as a, in some cases, as an encouragement.
Yeah, I mean, that tends to be my view, but I wonder if some people argue that whether we have the ITAR or not, that countries just become more prosperous or gonna want to start having those big
right. And that's back to, again, we're back at that logic argument that if you had a strategic intent by doing ITAR and it's not achieving that strategic goal and it's causing this economic friction, now it gives me the justification to talk about the economic friction. You have to buy on that first premise, though.
Yeah, but again, that's probably a tier issue also. I mean,
it is also a tier issue.
European hubris, who thrusters are on those satellites, is probably very different if it weren't for the ITAR.
And in many cases, we had plenty of global players, European players, who sat there and said, frankly, we would rather have used the American component because it's you know, better, cheaper, because you have more volume. You know, but yeah, and legacy, which as anybody knows in this industry, it's absolutely critical, right? And yet, I can't take the risk on my program because of the uncertainty. And so, there you had a difference between what sort of the overseas industry said versus the overseas customers, right? The overseas customers sort of saying, would have loved to use that component, but I can't take the risk of my program, so therefore, I kind of felt myself compelled to go down this other path. Right. And that really came out. Well, okay, one last comment, and then I
I didn't want to be the last one.
That's okay.
I really appreciate that report, but is it safe to say that defense basically is very much paralleling your findings in this report?
The broader defense?
Yes, and the second point is, do you have any information of a reciprocity situation, whereas foreign nations don't want to export to the United States because of your policies? And third and last, as this gentleman said over there, I would also have donut and coffee if my PAA is only 100 days. I've never had a PAA. I don't know where your averages are coming from, but that's just a fact of life. Have a saying, if it has hands and feet, it takes 9 months. That's more in line with the requirements we actually put in for
an EA. Yeah. Let me go backwards. The 106 days came, that was a direct result of the survey. So we asked the companies how much time was it taking, you know, per TAA. It's the tyranny of averages. Whether you're using mean or median, you know, and it's back to the anecdotes, everybody lives and screams about the tail. I suspect that tail is fatter than a normal distribution, so it's not going to reflect the average, but that is the average and whatever. But you know, everybody bitches and moans about what's above it. So I don't doubt that there are lots of. Let's put it this way: when they call you, they're probably already halfway down the slope, and they're not calling you to help with the easy stuff that's going by fast. So you're probably, that's part of the skewing of the data. That is the average. It doesn't mean that that's where, I mean, I'm sure that there is more that lives on that upper end. In terms of evidence of people not sending equipment here, I don't think we found any in space. I know for a fact it exists in the broader defense, where there have been clear-cut examples of companies and or allies saying, I am not going to contribute that technology into this interaction because it's going to get stuck in ITAR and I can't get it back out. And in particular, where we've really seen it is in the commercial world, commercial software, commercial IT, where some people are saying, I just will not deal with DoD or defense, even though it may be an interesting marketplace, because I don't want an ITAR taint to my product. So that I can point to. And frankly, that is a set of stuff that DoD doesn't even see it or know, or that's where the National Security Community doesn't even see or know it, because it's going on outside their purview, because these are people saying, I just don't want to deal with you, right? As far as the first question, can we find similar evidence sort of writ large in the broader defense world? I don't know. We spent so much time getting real hard data with the survey and all that I can't sit there and say, yes, I can find it. One of the reasons why we wanted to take on this study was very much the sense that, again, space was the early harbinger or the canary in the coal mine, vice lots of other sectors. I think in some of the other defense sectors, you will see more of an impact on the first tier than you would in this space, for example. Thank you for your time.